It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh City Paper has a new editor-in-chief. Managing editor Lisa Cunningham will be the Alternative Weekly's third leader in 2018 and the first woman in charge. She joins us in the WESA studios. Welcome to the Confluence, Lisa.
Thanks, Kevin.
Lisa, you've worked at City Paper since 1997. You've seen it grow. You've seen it change. First artistic director, managing editor under your predecessor, Rob Rossi. So at this point, less than a week into your stewardship, what are your goals so far?
I've been there since 97. I've had the artistic lead for a long time. I feel like I've been a champion for the local artists. What I would like to do is be a champion for everyone in our paper, for the people in our stories, for our staff, continue to support the arts in any way I can. I think we've been heading in a really good direction under Rob for the past few months. He immediately took my ideas and ran with them. He's listened to me and supported me the whole way, and I'd like to continue that and broaden it.
As managing editor, you were able to then, you know, get some of your ideas really into motion.
Yes, right away. I expressed to him that I feel like as a woman over the years, I had been silenced. He listened to me immediately, started listening to my ideas, took me under his wing, and I feel like he's been training me for this since he started.
So what instructions, if any, were you given by the owners, Eagle Media, which, of course, publishes the Butler Eagle and also the Cranberry Eagle?
I honestly only spoke to them on the phone for a short while when they offered me this position. What they did tell me is that they don't know our readers, and I assured them that I do. I worked there a really long time. I read things people say about us online. I'm always open to talk to people in person, and I do feel like I have a good, really good handle on the local art scene.
How do you get a grasp on readers? How do you sort of know what they want? What's your interaction? Your assessment of that?
From the very beginning, I know because I was a reader. I started here in college when we had two alt weeklies in Pittsburgh and City Paper. I picked them both up every week in college. When I graduated, I was offered a position because I went to school for journalism in both writing, and I was offered a part-time position at City Paper laying out the classified section. I chose City Paper because I loved it. I love all weeklies. As far as the readers, I speak to people about what they like. I'm an open book. I'm really heavily involved in social media. I read social media. I interact with people.
Is there any formal assessment? I mean, social media is an assessment, and your meeting with people is certainly an assessment. Is there any formal assessment that you do or plan to do from your readers, whether it's surveys or some other way of assessing their needs, their wants?
We have recently done a web survey where we got feedback on our website. We have a new digital media editor, Josh Oswald, who has been working on revamping our website and redesigning it. So that's really important to us, that people can read us both in print and online. We have a really strong social media team right now. We continue to get feedback back from them. I'll have to meet with our management team. I've been told that our pickup numbers are still strong, which is really important to me. But I do want to increase readership in both print, online, and social media.
So as I mentioned, you're the third editor-in-chief in less than 5 months. Charlie Deitch was dismissed in the spring. His replacement, Rob Rossi, who you mentioned, has decided to pursue other opportunities after less than 5 months on the job. Are you concerned at all about the stability of the newspaper, which has been a key part of this community for nearly three decades?
I'm a realist. I know print media has been struggling, but as far as City Paper stability, I would say that I am the stable person that has been there since 1997. I've been there through every step, every change. I've worked with multiple editors over the years. I've been behind the scenes this entire time. People aren't familiar with me. They don't know my name because I'm very shy. I'm social anxiety. This makes me very nervous being on the radio, but I've been behind the scenes making decisions this entire time. You just didn't know it.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the decisions. You said earlier you wanted to work for an alt weekly coming out of school. What is your assessment in general about alt weeklies? I mean, dozens of storied papers have shuttered. They've reduced their staffs in recent years. New York's Village Voice closed just this summer. So How is City Paper doing financially? You were talking about pickups are still pretty strong, and you want to increase, you know, online reading as well as the physical paper. So how are you doing financially?
I haven't met with the management team yet. I hope to get more inside info. I know we still have ads in our paper. I'm really excited that we are still here. I think it's devastating that places like the Village Voice have closed. I think it says a lot about us that we're still here and we still continue to put out a good product. But yeah, I am optimistic about our future. I think we can be more fun than ever other outlets. And I think that I bring a new creative energy to the position. And I hope to bring creative storytelling to the paper as well.
Well, when you see your sister organizations in decline, does it affect your mission at all, how you even cover news in their absence?
It motivates me to keep working stronger. I'll be honest and say this is the strongest editorial staff we've had in a really long time as far as the energy that our staff has. Every single person gets along, which is amazing for a newsroom, and not just editorially, going to marketing, sales, production. We're a very strong team, so I think that we're going to continue to grow.
So how will your background inform how you lead? Your background both at the Pittsburgh City Paper and also your background in the arts, your strong interest in the arts. So your journalism background at City Paper and your artistic background.
I think that I'm going to be an unconventional editor. I've worked with editors that have the hard news background. I don't, but I really appreciate the news. Ryan Dito is a very strong news writer. He continues to write about news and politics on our website every week. But my background really is in the arts, and I care about the arts community. I like to go to local theater. I just saw Kinetic Theater's The Father at New Hazlet, which was amazing. I'm excited to see The Nightmare Before Christmas at the Symphony later this month. I go out. I love Pittsburgh's art scene, and I hope to continue to showcase that and the people behind the scenes there.
All right, Lisa. Now, some might say that I buried the lead, okay, but I wanted to work up to it just as you've worked up to editor-in-chief. You're the first female editor-in-chief for Pittsburgh City Paper. What does that mean to you?
It's a lot of pressure, I would say, but I've been overwhelmed with the message of support that I've gotten this week from people I've worked with, from past coworkers, from people in the art scene. One of my artists sent me a message, a male artist, and said that it's people like me that are going to pave the way for his daughter. And that's really touched me, and I hope I can do them proud.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you, do you think it might even mean more for young female journalists?
I hope so. We have really strong female journalists on our staff right now, and I hope to do them well.
When Rob Rossi appeared on The Confluence in May, he said that he and you wanted to restore Pittsburgh City Paper to its roots in terms of focused coverage on arts and entertainment. So where are you on the road toward that?
Well, we did redesign a bunch of pages, which I think is really important. I think that having a product look good is going to make people read our words. So we've really been working on that. I've been laying out the paper for a really long time. So every week, every weekly cover, every story you see has been laid out by me. And I have a really strong production staff who I'm going to train to help me out now. I do think that we've been doing more with telling the story about local arts organizations. I'd like to continue that. I'd like to have it look good. I'd like to have the stories read well. And I'd like to have fun.
So having fun. What's fun mean for you? You've used that phrase, have fun, a couple of times now.
The world's a mess right now. I want people to be able to pick up the paper and take a load off, laugh, learn something. I want to entertain them and educate them.
What do you want to teach them about? I don't know, teach is such a strong word. What do you want to educate them? What do you want to let them know about?
Well, as a woman and somebody who has worked behind the scenes, I think it's important not to just tell the stories of the people that you know about, but the people that are the ones working in Pittsburgh, the ones making the theater sets. I want to know their stories.
Okay. Just want to know their stories. That's at the essence. That's what journalism is, telling stories, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So in the City Paper story announcing your appointment, the outgoing editor-in-chief, Rob Rossi, was quoted as saying, Lisa Cunningham is the soul of City Paper. Frankly, it's long overdue that somebody with an arts background is calling the shots at this place, end quote. So how do you tap that great experience that you have in the arts community without maybe crossing the line as a journalist into advocacy journalism?
Well, I think it's important to tell people's stories, but I also think it's important to tell the truth. I do not plan on catering to any advertiser. I want to tell the stories that are important, that our staff thinks are important.
You've hired diverse local artists to create all city papers, illustrations. Why is that so important to you?
Pittsburgh has such a huge resource of artists. I just really think it's important that we show off and be a local paper and include local people.
So you're tapping their talents to better your newspaper?
Correct. I don't want to be the face of city paper. I want the people we write about to be the face of city paper.
Even though you're editor-in-chief now, you still want to, you know, sort of pull back.
I'm a very shy editor-in-chief.
But I think you have some strong ideas about what you want to do in the future?
Yes. One thing I'm really excited about is this week, Rob and I signed up Jesse Sage, a local sex worker and activist, to do a new column in the paper called Peep Show based on our podcast. So that's one more reason, one more diverse voice we're going to be including in the paper. And I would love to have more people reach out to me with ideas.
What would you use as criteria for deciding this could work? Or will you be sort of testing it out, you know, with more diverse ideas?
I don't think people are going to notice a difference immediately. We have a month's worth of issues planned out, but I would like to continue to hear ideas and talk about them. I've already been influencing and giving story ideas all along the way, and I'll continue to do that. I would like to have more diverse people of color in the paper, so always open to hearing new ideas.
As you know, one of your former editors-in-chief, Charlie Deitch, started another alternative paper this summer. Can two free alternatives exist financially in this city? And if so, how so? Because, as you alluded to earlier, other papers are having difficulties financially.
I like to focus on what we're doing and not what other people are doing, but I would never wish any print media company to shut down at any point. Print media is very important, and I'd like to see it continue to grow.
Final thing, what are the next immediate steps for Lisa Cunningham, Pittsburgh City Paper?
Cross my fingers and hope for the best.
Lisa Cunningham is the new editor-in-chief of Pittsburgh City Paper. Lisa, congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESN.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, 49 states allocate funding for public defenders, and usually that money is tied to oversight and standards. Not so in Pennsylvania. Keystone Crossroads debuts part two in their week-long series about the Commonwealth's patchwork public defense system. Plus, a conversation about the Heinz History Museum's new exhibit on the Apollo 11 lunar module. All that and more coming up on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
There's something to be said about the purity of music made among families. However, these brothers ain't talking, at least not to each other. Now, it wasn't always that way with the Gallagher brothers of Oasis. Nah, just kidding. Their relationship has been a mess for years. Luckily, they've been able to keep it together to make some very memorable albums. Their big breakthrough, What's the Story Morning Glory, was released on this day in 1995 and found success with songs like Champagne Supernova and Wonderwall. The questions remain, how many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high? For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Public Schools police officers want to carry firearms. The city school district employs 22 of its own sworn police officers, but it has a policy that prohibits them from carrying guns. Monday night, the school board listened to the district's police chief making his case for repealing that policy. But as 90.5 WESA Sarah Schneider reports, a majority of the nine board members voice skepticism.
Chief George Brown says his officers need guns in order to protect students and staff from outside threats.
We're trying to keep the streets out of our schools.
While some officers are stationed in schools, others float between buildings. But regardless of where they are located, he says officers are always on the lookout for potential harm to students. He pointed to lockdowns at schools when there were fatal shootings nearby.
But we were working hard every 5 minutes to make sure you guys had a smile on your face and that you were able to get an education.
And you guys were able to do that without guns, right?
Yes, but that in the report.
That's school board member Maura Kaleida. She opposes arming officers, as did many of the people who filled the room at Pittsburgh Public Schools Administration Building in Oakland during a policy workshop. A majority of board members voiced strong concern about the consequences of bringing guns into schools.
We know who gets shot, right? We know that it's going to be the young Black students. We know it's going to be the kids with disabilities.
Data show Black students are disproportionately arrested by officers employed by the district. That's part of the reason Darlene Figgs, a former PPS educator, now with the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network, says she worries routine interactions between students and police would escalate.
I think that if we look at what's happening in this country outside of the school system, there's no reason to think that inside of the school system would be any different.
This conversation between school police and the board has been at least 3 years in the making. Pittsburgh Public's officers and security guards are unionized and represented by the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers. In 2015, the union's executive board approved a resolution that recommended the district issue firearms. The following year, the union approached board members individually. Bill Heilman with the PFT agrees with Chief Brown. He says officers say they need guns in order to protect students from intruders.
This in no way is a call by the PFT or the police that we represent because they feel there's some need in the hallways of our schools.
Heilman says the union wants a seat at the table during this discussion, but for years it wasn't a public conversation. Then in February, 17 people were killed in a Parkland, Florida high school shooting. And President Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos suggested teachers carry weapons. The Pittsburgh School Board was quick to shut that idea down. It approved a resolution this summer saying the district would not arm staff. Superintendent Anthony Hamlet also believes guns don't belong in school and says outside threats can be addressed by Pittsburgh city officers. But two board members continue to keep this conversation going. Terry Kennedy chairs the safety committee and said listening to employees is part of the board's job.
And if our school police officers feel strongly that they need some more tools, I think we owe them the respect to be open-minded and listen to their message.
Board member Cindy Falls was not at the meeting, but said in an email that she supported arming the officers. No other board members openly voiced support for the proposal. The board will vote on the policy change at its October 24th meeting. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking this week about Pennsylvania's system for public defense. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that states have the responsibility to ensure that constitutional right. 49 states provide at least some funding. Pennsylvania does not. As Katie Meyer reports, as far as most state lawmakers are concerned, that's just fine.
Do you remember when that was?
I don't have the date, but...
It's July, and the state legislature is recessed for the summer. The Capitol is mostly empty of politicians. Senator Stuart Greenleaf is about to leave his office, but given a chance to talk about public defense, he sticks around a little longer.
That's part of our Constitution. It says to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. And it starts out.
Greenleaf's issue with the way Pennsylvania pays for public defense goes back to the U.S. Constitution. The courts say states need to make sure the resource is there, but Pennsylvania leaves the matter totally up to its counties. And so Greenleaf says the state can't possibly be doing its job.
I mean, there should be a quality defense. I mean, it's not should be the defense that, well, we're going to do this on the cheap.
For several sessions in a row now, Greenleaf, a Montgomery County Republican who chairs the Senate's powerful Judiciary Committee, has been introducing bills that would reform the public defense system and create an infrastructure that could route state money to county offices.
One of the biggest problems is they don't have the money to hire more public defenders. So as a result, their caseload is way too high. And they're excellent lawyers, but you can only handle so many cases.
As the only state that doesn't provide any funding for public defense, Pennsylvania regularly catches flack from groups like the American Civil Liberties Union. They say the lack of oversight and organized data makes it difficult to figure out what's happening at each of the state's 67 public defender's offices. And a Keystone Crossroads investigation confirmed that it takes an exhaustive, piecemeal approach to even begin to get a clear picture. What emerges is that there are vast differences in resources and staff from county to county. Nisa Taylor, a one-time Philadelphia public defender who now works for the ACLU, said in the decade she spent representing indigent clients, her job was one of the cushiest. And that's saying something.
Public defenders are uniformly overworked. It was an excellent office. I had excellent bosses. I would still go into court and represent 30 people sometimes in one day.
More than a decade ago, Pennsylvania's Joint State Government Commission was tasked with studying the Commonwealth's public defense system. In 2011, it released a scathing report that found, among other things, the state's lack of supervision and training for defenders means some don't do their jobs well. Low salaries mean defenders turn over quickly, and there's no way to collect enough data to fully figure out the scope of the problems. Unlike every other bordering state, Pennsylvania does not have a commission on public defense. Greenleaf was one of four senators on the task force for the issue. He says when the report came out, he was hopeful people would listen. But now, 7 years and a pile of failed bills later, not so much.
No. That's the answer, no.
A big reason why Greenleaf's reforms haven't gone anywhere is leaders in his own party have largely ignored them. Asked why that is, he's careful not to ruffle any feathers.
They think they've done it. They think they have solved the problem. They've gotten the county to come up with the money. And it is functioning. But how well it is another matter.
If you try to ask GOP leaders about funding public defense, that certainly seems to be the case. Individual lawmakers say they don't know much about the situation because it's not a priority. Governor Tom Wolf has the issue on his list of criminal justice reform goals, but hasn't spent much time on it. And it's not a high priority for other top Democrats, like the Auditor General and Attorney General. Phyllis Subin, a one-time Philly public defender and legal professor, has a theory about why there's been so little movement.
I think that there is a political hesitancy to support anything that might smack of an accusation that you're soft on crime and supporting criminals.
Subin says in her years lobbying for public defense funding in Harrisburg, she's repeatedly felt herself pitted against prosecutors in the eyes of lawmakers. And Nisa Taylor with the ACLU says she has felt that same tension.
It makes their job harder, right? To some extent, DAs don't want a good PD. Because they're going to start losing. I don't mean that as like flip, but like things move more seamlessly for them if things are just a plea factory.
The State District Attorneys Association doesn't have any official position on whether public defenders should get money from the state. But in the past, they've testified that if PDs get state funding, they need more too. District Attorney Association Executive Director Rich Long says that DA offices have a wider range of responsibilities than PDs. They don't just prosecute. They coordinate with law enforcement and assist in other related duties.
It's a little broader charge than the public defender's office, which is strictly charged with defending individuals in criminal cases.
Other states have had better luck overhauling their public defense systems. Utah used to be just like Pennsylvania, but recently added oversight and some funding. Just north, in New York, a lawsuit pushed the state to provide about half of what it takes to fund public defense. But in Pennsylvania, it's mostly just Greenleaf.
No, I think it was appropriate at 1 year.
After serving as a key Republican voice on the issue for years, he's retiring from public office in January. He says he's not sure who, if anyone, will take up the mantle.
I don't know the answer to that question because I don't know. I'd hope that there would be other people that would know that this is an important issue. But I can't answer that. I don't know what's going to happen in the future.
The one area that's seen any progress on reforming Pennsylvania's public defense system has been county-level lawsuits, and those haven't made any difference statewide. Katie Meyer for Keystone Crossroads.
The Keystone Crossroads series on the public defense system looks at reforms in Allegheny County. That's tomorrow on The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
That was the sound of the Apollo 11 lunar module landing on the moon, July 1969. It's now landed in Pittsburgh at the Heinz History Center as part of the Destination Moon exhibit that continues into February. We're going to talk about the mission, the exhibit, and our past, present, and future in space with Jay Apt, former astronaut who flew on four shuttle missions. Jay's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University and co-director of CMU's Electricity Industry Station Center. Welcome, Jay. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
And in studio is Andy Masick, the president and CEO of the Heinz History Center, which is hosting Destination Moon through February 18th. Welcome, Andy.
Good morning.
I still get excited when I hear that audio. What about you? We're going to start with you, Jay. Do you still get excited?
Absolutely. That was an incredible time. I was fortunate enough to be at the Cape for the launch on the 16th of July, 1969. And I was watching on a black and white television set on Cape Cod the landing and, of course, the first spacewalk. And it thrills me now almost as much as hearing President Kennedy's challenge to the nation that we choose to go to the moon and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And Andy, you still get excited by that? I saw you smile when you were listening to that.
I get goosebumps, Kevin. It still happens every time. I was a kid. I was about 14 years old when the moonwalk occurred. And what strikes me now is how the whole world focused on that orb out there in space and the human beings walking on the moon. It wasn't just an American thing. It was something that made the people of the world awed and proud at the same time.
Now, this exhibit is obviously special, but the Heinz History Center is one of just four nationwide to host the exhibit with the spacecraft transported from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Okay, Andy, aside from the lunar module, you can't name that. What's your favorite part of the exhibit?
Well, I love the fact that there are all kinds of Pittsburgh connections in the exhibit. I mean, they couldn't have gone to the moon without Pittsburgh. But if you got right down to artifacts in the exhibit, my favorite is the piece of the Wright Flyer, the 1903 Wright Flyer, a piece of wood and a piece of canvas that Neil Armstrong brought with him on the lunar lander. Each of them were allowed to bring personal preference items. And he made that connection between 1903, when the Wright brothers proved that human beings could fly, to human beings walking on the surface of the moon 66 years later. I get goosebumps thinking about that.
All right. Jay, I know you've seen the exhibit. Aside from the module, do you have a favorite artifact or something that you saw from the exhibit that tickles you?
You know, what I really liked was seeing the prototype that Westinghouse built of the black and white television camera that showed us Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. The technology was in its infancy in those days, and to make a space-rated camera that could send back those images was fabulous, and that was done right here in Westinghouse. And all of the other connections that the History Center has brought to life with the Western Pennsylvania industry that contributed to Apollo, I thought was just fascinating.
Boy, I have to agree with you, Jay. All those Pittsburgh connections from the command module itself, which was made by North American Rockwell, a Pittsburgh-based firm, to the Westinghouse cameras that brought us those first images from the moon. But then there's ATI and U.S. Steel and Alcoa that built the skin and the infrastructure for the Saturn V rocket and the command module and the lunar lander. And then all the other Pittsburgh connections, and including some of the breathing apparatus used by the astronauts, done by MSA, the safety people. In fact, they were so uncertain about what was really on the moon that MSA had to reverse the valves on some of the respirators. So when the astronauts came home, they would trap or capture anything that they breathed out, because there, who knows, there might be moon spores or viruses or something that could wipe out the human race. That's how little we knew about space then. And then, of course, there's the flag that's on the moon today, that flag that stands out all by itself as if it's waving in the wind. But as you know, Jay, there's no wind on the moon. That was designed by Jack Kinsler, a Pittsburgher who became the head of the sort of fix-it department at NASA. Any kind of tough problem that need to be MacGyvered through, they gave it to Jack Kinsler, and he came up with this flag that had a cantilevered arm on it that made the flag stand out straight and could be collapsible and carried on the lunar lander.
Jay, I have to ask
you. You know, Jack lived two or three houses down from me when I lived in Houston, and he helped train us on the shuttle. He was just an amazing guy and shows the Pittsburgh spirit of the ability to get things done. I think that was just wonderful to bring that as part of the exhibit, Andy.
And did you know, Jay, that Jack had a fourth grade education? He was just,
I did indeed.
He was a natural, and he was self-taught and was mechanically inclined, kind of like you, growing up with your father's shop in the basement and working on trains and things, and being a model builder.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jack would have loved the virtual reality fly-through that you have of the command module, where folks, you can't crawl in the command module. I mean, after all, it's been around the moon 50 years ago, and it's an artifact that will forever define one of the high points of our civilization, going to the moon. But you can crawl around it in the virtual reality simulator that you guys have got there. It's just a fantastic experience to be able to poke around the command module.
All right, Jay, I got to ask you. So you can poke around in it, but you didn't go into space until 22 years after Apollo 11. And that was on board, I believe your first mission was on board the shuttle Atlantis. Is there anything inside you that says, I would have liked to have been inside Apollo 11 at the time?
Well, of course, that was just a fantastic achievement that people made, and folks are doing amazing things in space all the time, but firsts, they're very hard to come by. I was lucky enough to be involved with the robotic space program when we were going out for the first time to turn the planets from little points of light into real worlds that we can now explore. But I loved being on the U.S. space shuttles and being able to go outside in a spacesuit built here in this country and just to see this beautiful planet from outside. And I think having this exhibit at the Heinz History Center is just going to excite a whole new generation of folks to do things that are going to be fantastic and will make the things that our generation did look small in comparison. I loved being there and seeing the students on Saturday launch rockets out in the parking lot. I love the kind of things that are being done to involve students in the exhibit, and I hope everybody in Pittsburgh goes to see it.
Well, Jay, I got to ask you, one of the other benefits of the shuttle is you got to land on a runway rather than plop an Apollo capsule into the ocean.
Well, that's true. Landing on a runway was a lot of fun, but any way that you get into space and get back to Earth is a lot of fun. I think the kinds of things that SpaceX is doing at the moment are tremendously exciting. My former students who are working out there are just as excited as the people that I knew in Houston who had worked on Apollo. It's a tremendously exciting time, and kids these days recognize it.
I want to talk a little bit about the future and Pittsburgh's contributions. You've alluded to that already. So the Pittsburgh area has contributed at least five astronauts that have flown in space, including Jay, plus Michael Fink, Terry Hart, James Irwin, Stephen Frick. Newcastle's Andrew Morgan is now in the pipeline for a mission. Of course, Jay was born in Massachusetts, but we claim him since he graduated high school here. But, Andy, the exhibit also talks, as you alluded to, the companies that were much a part of the Apollo 11, but also there's a connection to the future of space exploration as well with Pittsburgh.
You bet. You know that Red Whitaker and the robotics people from CMU are leading the way in robotics, and there's a spinoff company called Astrobotic. John Thornton, the CEO, was just at the History Center yesterday talking about the Peregrine lunar lander that they're building and will be on the moon in another year. There's also an Andy rover that Astrobotic has designed. It's got photovoltaics all over it and can go any place on the moon. So those are just some of the things that are happening right here in Pittsburgh that will lead to the next generation of exploration on the moon and on Mars and beyond.
Jay, whether it's the students that you teach or Andy, the children and their parents who visit the Heinz History Center, is there still a sense of excitement about space travel, something like when we felt years ago? Jay, we'll start with you then, Andy.
Absolutely. There's no question that when you talk to the folks who are working at the cutting-edge companies like SpaceX, you see that sense of excitement. Folks are doing new things in space. The idea of landing two booster rockets simultaneously when the Falcon 9 Heavy launched was just amazing, a tremendous sense of achievement and excitement among folks. And some of the traditional companies are doing exciting things as well. Now, it's just a great time, and the sorts of things that we'll be doing in the 21st and 22nd centuries just awe me.
Mm-hmm. Is there a follow-up real quick to you, Jay? Do you sense that there's as much attention being paid because most of what's now in the pipeline right now is unmanned space?
Oh, I think that these things go hand in hand. There is no funding for the robotic program without funding for the human program. That's an empirical observation. And we see that there's no funding for the human spaceflight program without the sort of excitement that's generated by the robotic program. They go hand in hand.
I was delighted just the other day to see so many families coming to the History Center to see Destination Moon, multi-generational families, mom, dad, the kids, and the grandparents all sharing stories. But what really struck me was all the little girls in line and interacting with the lunar lander or picking up moon rocks. And I talked to several of them, and they want to be astronauts. Those little girls want to be astronauts, and the boys too. But I think there's a connection between popular culture, fiction, movies, video games, and creating a sense of excitement and possibility for what's out there, in space. And that's dovetailing with the STEM education that's going on, science, technology, engineering, and math that we're doing at the History Center and the Science Center's doing, and others are too. So I think that there is that excitement. And when you saw those kids, I agree with you, Jay, when they were launching those rockets the other day at the History Center, you saw the wonder in their eyes.
And final,
as I see it all the time here at CMU, people are doing exploration, whether it's in computers or in space or in other aspects of science. And Pittsburgh has always been at the forefront. Having this History Center exhibit is just a tremendous asset for Pittsburgh. And Andy, thank you for bringing it here.
Jay Abt, who flew four space shuttle missions, is a CMU professor. Andy Masick is the president of the Heinz History Center. Thanks so much to both of you. The Destination Moon exhibit with the star attraction, the Apollo 11 lunar module, will be on display at the Heinz History Center through February 18th. And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On tomorrow's show, when you transfer from one bus to another, you want to make sure you make your connection. We'll talk about the Port Authority CEO, Catherine Kelman, about how she's connecting with the community. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.